All right. Well, welcome, everybody, to this bi-monthly conflict-free leadership call hosted by the National Physicians Alliance as part of its Unbranded Doctor Project, which takes place under the Partnership to Advance Conflict-Free Medical Education Grant, affectionately known as PACME. I am Rachel DeGolia, facilitator for this call and a board member of the National Physicians Alliance. In my day job, I direct the Universal Healthcare Action Network. So, according to our pre-registrations as of yesterday, we have a really good mix of physicians, faculty, medical students from across the country on this call from at least 20 states plus the District of Columbia. So we're thrilled about that. And what I'm going to suggest now, because we do have a really good crowd on the call tonight, is that everybody mute your lines. You can do that by welcome. Oh, welcome, Ed. We're just getting started. So I'm just asking everyone except for you, Ed, to mute their lines, *6. That way any background noise, we won't hear it. And at any point when we have, we'll have, you know, a good half of the call will be Q&A and discussion. You can unmute your line at any time by hitting *6 again. All right, everybody, thank you so much. So a little background on the PACME project under whose auspices this call is taking place. The PACME, again, stands for Partnership to Advance Conflict-Free Medical Education. The PACME grant is the result of a state attorney general settlement regarding the inappropriate marketing of the drug Neurontin. Partners for this grant include, in addition to the National Physicians Alliance, the American Medical Student Association, Community Catalyst, and the Pew Charitable Trust. And I'm sure we have folks from all those partners on the call with us this evening. The goal of the project is to reduce conflicts of interest created by the pharmaceutical industry in the medical profession and in medical research. And the grant promotes a whole number of approaches to raise awareness of this issue, including these conference calls that we have every 2 months. For more information about the National Physicians Alliance and the project, please visit the NPA Unbranded Doctor website at npalliance.org/conflict-free. So, holding the industry accountable, covering pharmaceutical industry marketing practices is the topic for our call tonight. Ed Silverman, our guest speaker, is a prize-winning journalist who has covered the pharmaceutical industry for the past 18 years. Welcome. We're asking folks as they join the call to please mute your line so everyone can hear it. *6. Ed was bureau chief and contributor for several industry publications as well as a business writer for the Star Ledger of New Jersey. It is there that Ed conceived and launched PharmaLot, a popular blog covering pharmaceutical biotech industry news, which only recently closed down. During his 13-year tenure with PharmaLot, Ed closely followed a variety of topics of concern to those who work for and with drug makers, including drug development, mergers and acquisitions, regulatory oversight, safety and pricing controversies, and marketing issues. The timing of our call with Ed tonight is very auspicious, given the huge settlement just this past November by Johnson & Johnson, which was characterized by the U.S. Justice Department as one of the largest healthcare fraud settlements in history. Your agenda tonight included a link to Ed's article about that settlement. I'm closing the door so you all don't have to listen to my dog barking. Okay. About this case, which and the case aimed to resolve criminal and civil lawsuits over the improper prescribing of Risperdal and two other medicines, as well as kickbacks that were paid to physicians and to Omnicare, the largest nursing home pharmacy in the country, to boost prescriptions of these medications. So I won't say anything more about that. We're going to hear about that from Ed. But a word about the format for this call, especially for those of you for whom it's your first time. What we're going to do is Ed will present for the first 20 or 25 minutes of the call until maybe around 9:30 Eastern time. And then we'll throw the floor open for questions and answers and comments. Joining Ed and responding to questions will be two of the partners for the PACME project, Wells Wilkinson, who is director of the Prescription Access Litigation Project at Community Catalyst, and Steve Smith, MD, Professor Emeritus of Family Medicine at the Warren Alpert Medical School at Brown University, who is a founding board member of NPA, National Physicians Alliance, and a consultant with Community Catalyst. Wells and Steve can help direct you to resources and tools that can help you address conflicts of interest at academic medical centers and or the medical profession wherever you are. So right now, let me just remind folks to please mute your lines if you haven't already, star 6. And as I said, you can unmute them when it's time for Q&A, doing the same thing, star 6. So I just want to say, usually on these calls, we have Ann Wollison, who is the Education Director of the National Physicians Alliance, but Ann was called away tonight due to a family health emergency. So in her stead, we have Becky Martin, who is Director of Special Projects or of Projects Management for the National Physicians Alliance, who is going to say a few words, and then we'll get right on to our speaker. Becky.
Thank you, Rachel. We just want to welcome everybody to the call tonight. Thank you for making time for this important subject. And this is the 12th in a series of calls, and those recordings of all the calls as well as written notes can be found at www.npalliance.org/conflict-free. If anybody has any questions, they're welcome. We'll be giving out contact additional contact information at the end of the call. Thank you.
All right, thanks. So now I am pleased to welcome Ed Silverman to begin tonight's presentation on holding the pharmaceutical industry accountable. Welcome, Ed.
Hi, thank you very much. Hello, everybody, and thank you for being here. I hope you can hear me. And,
yeah, absolutely.
Good. Okay, because I'm using a new phone. I haven't quite adjusted to it yet. So I'll give you a quick summary of what I've been doing and how I came to be following this particular topic. I joined the Star Ledger of New Jersey, one of the larger papers in the country, or certainly in 1995 when I got there, it was, what happened to newspapers. And I began covering the pharmaceutical industry, and back then the pharmaceutical industry was largely fat and happy. Lots of drugs were approved, including Me Too drugs. The notion of a blockbuster drug was something that was relatively common, and companies were making a lot of money. And as a business writer who was new to the industry, other than a grandfather had been a pharmacist in Brooklyn his whole life, I really didn't know anything about it. I was like most people who did not know which company made which medicine in my bathroom. So it was not rocket science to figure out that, well, everybody's making money. What am I going to write about if they're always making money? Isn't there something else? And, of course, there's stories about R&D and M&A and also marketing. And I decided that rather than just write about how much was made, I wanted to write about how it was made. And I started delving into marketing and promotion issues as part of that. And it was very educational. And over time, I found that when I wrote stories about some of the strategies and tactics employed by large drug makers, I would get phone calls and letters, this is before the internet took over, and later emails from people who would say, you know, you really ought to look at this, you really ought to look at that, including attorneys who represented people that who had filed what we call whistleblower or key Tom lawsuits that alleged various shenanigans designed to bolster the prescriptions of this or that medicine. And, of course, I'm sure you all know as much about this, if not more than I do, but there have been many such allegations in the form of lawsuits over the years, an increasing number filed against the pharmaceutical industry. And it, without being critical or judgmental, my experience in following and writing about this phenomena is that the business practices are almost, not to simplistically exaggerate, but the business practices that were often utilized to bolster prescriptions, as described in some of these whistleblower suits involving kickbacks and related activities, also seemed to be another form of patented business, because almost every large drug maker has had one or more settlements over the past several years, a decade, let's say, in which they have had to pay a settlement to resolve allegations of kickbacks and other practices. And time and again, as I went through the lawsuits and talked to the attorneys and talked to the prosecutors and talked to, when possible, the individual whistleblowers, a lot of the activities were very familiar. You could almost fill in the blank. You know, take out the name of the drug maker and the drug or drugs involved and pop in another set, and the practices were almost uniform. And, of course, that reflects to a certain extent that there's just so many ways to go about boosting prescriptions and the way the industry is set up and the way marketing can be conducted or is practiced when it comes to reaching physicians. And it's hard to say that any one particular example is more egregious than another. I think it's all relative, because if you're a state Medicaid director, you might say, we lost, we spent unnecessarily X amount of dollars because this mid-sized drug maker was overcharging or performing or conducting business inappropriately, and as a result, our budget was hurt. So it's all relative. But the Johnson & Johnson example, I guess, is perhaps one of the more interesting and notable ones for a few reasons. It was very long running, probably because J&J fought very hard to negotiate the settlement that was reached 2 months ago now, back in November. It was long rumored it was to be reached. It was long rumored it would be $2.2 billion. But it also came in dribs and drabs, because it involved different J&J units or subsidiaries, different drugs, and some of these had been resolved in sort of piecemeal fashion over the last few years. But they all ended up being announced as part of an umbrella settlement back in November. But it was also an interesting and notable case, because it almost reached to the top, in the sense that at one point the federal prosecutors were leaning quite hard on Alice Gorsky, who is currently the J&J CEO, but at the time that some of these activities occurred, he was a key executive further down the ladder, but a key executive nonetheless, who had direct oversight and responsibility for some of the practices that led to the either inflated prices or kickbacks that were detailed in the settlement. And that's sort of an unusual thing, because I think one of the issues that has emerged, and I think it's a legitimate criticism, not one easily resolved, but it's a legitimate criticism, that for all these different settlements that the federal government has reached with the large number of drug makers, the reality is that the fines or settlements are paid, they're legal, associated legal costs, they're not trifling sums, but J&J's $2.2 billion settlement is still nothing near what was sold in the form of revenues generated by the key drug involved, which is the Risperdal antipsychotic, which racked up billions more in sales. So the sad reality is that the companies have, over time, regarded these practices as quote-unquote, a cost of doing business. And I'm not pointing a finger when I say that. I recall, to my surprise, being in Philadelphia about, I want to say 6 years ago, I attended an industry conference, and I was asked to speak for a few minutes on a panel, And after I was done, someone from another large, from a large drug maker, not J&J, got up and was talking about settlements. This is a regulatory slash compliance officer. And this person literally said that these settlements are viewed as a cost of doing business. And so there it was. It wasn't something that one could nefariously ascribe and unfairly subscribe. There it was. I saw and heard it myself, which was interesting. I was surprised it was admitted. Maybe the person forgot I was in the room. But in any event, the point I'm leading to is that as a result, the money is paid, and then the question is, does business continue as usual? The federal government has tried, the Office of Inspector General, the Health and Human Services Department, has tried to get tough, so to speak, with the pharmaceutical industry in light of these many settlements. They've tried to bolster what's known as a corporate integrity agreement that would have some teeth by requiring the board of directors and top executives, as the case may be, to sign off on certain reports, install mechanisms for greater regulatory oversight or compliance oversight. There are even clawback provisions. But the problem is that no one has actually been, they haven't gone after anybody yet. The closest that the federal government has come to something like that was with Purdue Pharma a few years ago and the misbranding of the OxyContin painkiller. Three executives were excluded from doing business with the federal government, federal health care program specifically. And that's sort of a death knell for a company whose executive cannot do business because that limits the company. So that's a rather serious step. But that hasn't happened really very often. Another attempt was made at Howard Solomon, who was running Forest Laboratories, but the feds backed off. And I much later learned, very belatedly learned, that there was some pressure put on the White House to try to ease up. I learned that one of the U.S. senators from New York called the White House trying to get the Obama administration to back off, or to get HHS, Office of Inspector General, to back off and not exclude Solomon, because why? Forest Laboratory is a major employer, and I didn't look into whether there was political contributions. It was so long after the fact, but it was very interesting, and not surprising this sort of thing happens, but it does, and it did. So where does that leave us? We have this $2.2 billion settlement with J&J. The pharmaceutical industry, by and large, is very quick to say, look, yes, there have been a lot of settlements. A lot of settlements have occurred in the last few years. But often, if you look closely, the allegations reflect practices or activities that occurred 6 years ago, 8 years ago, 10 years ago even, as the case may be. And we've changed since then. We understand there are penalties, we understand the seriousness and the consequences. We've put in place this, or this to improve compliance, and we know not to do that again. In fact, Andrew Witty, the GlaxoSmithKline CEO, saying that kind of tune about a year and a half ago when Glaxo reached its own settlement, a $3 billion settlement with the government for its own shenanigans. And, I'd like to point out that, it remains to be seen, though, whether this sort of thing is really of the past or if it's still going on. In the past year, Novartis has faced lawsuits from the federal government concerning some of its activities. Twice last April, in fact, the U.S. Justice Department filed lawsuits alleging Novartis paid kickbacks to Boots prescriptions and as a result caused Medicare, Medicaid, and VA, and whoever else to overpay for the drug is based on false claims. And what I found interesting, and I'm just going back to that story. I'm sorry I don't have it to show you, but I actually read about it for Forbes. And if you do a search for Forbes, Silverman, and Novartis, if you have a screen in front of you, the story ran April 27th of last year. And at the time, what I found interesting was that Preet Bharara, the U.S. attorney in Manhattan, declared Novartis as a repeat offender. And he was referring to a case 3 years earlier, which would have been 2010, in which Novartis paid more than $422 million in penalties and pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor to resolve criminal allegations for improperly promoting a few of its drugs. And as a result of that settlement, Novartis signed a 5-year corporate integrity agreement, which, as I mentioned, requires the company to establish internal compliance programs and report violations. And that was signed specifically in September 2010, and it runs 5 years. Yet both lawsuits that were filed last spring by the Justice Department alleged that the various infractions occurred afterwards. In other words, this raised the question whether the CIA was violated. And I raised a similar question concerning GlaxoSmithKline back in the summer. Why? I'm just going to that backstory as well. As part of that $3 billion settlement that Glaxo signed in summer of 2012, again, there was a corporate integrity agreement. And the question becomes whether the recent bribery scandal that's taking place in China could be considered a violation of the corporate integrity agreement. And so I asked the HHS Office of Inspector General, might there be a violation? Is that going to be examined? They told me, and I'm going to read the actual comment I received from the Office of Inspector General, who said, "Our corporate integrity agreements focus on U.S. laws, especially those relating to federal health care programs. However, if conduct that happened overseas also violated applicable U.S. laws, we would assess whether the situation implicated any CIA or corporate integrity agreement provisions." So we've not yet seen any action from OIG on this matter. But I asked the question to raise the issue because whether it happens in the U.S. or China, we're still seeing the same behavior. Now, with Glaxo, I don't know if any U.S. laws are violated or if OIG has determined that or finished determining that or what. I have to follow up. I've admittedly not done that since last summer. But we're still seeing the same behavior. And the excuse we've heard from Glaxo is that there are some out-of-control executives at the local or domestic level in China. But the company is still supposed to, across the board, the CIA only pertains to the U.S., of course, but the company should have learned the lesson that this behavior is not tolerated, it's not viewed as acceptable, so why weren't there better checks and balances put in place in China, for instance, as well as the U.S.? There's a very long conversation I'm sure we could have about that. Someone could liken so-called emerging markets to the Wild West, and perhaps the drug makers are more sensitive to the scrutiny that's applied here than elsewhere. So for the time being, the excuse will always be that there's a fall guy or more in this or that country. But that doesn't unfortunately solve the problem. And so I tend to think that while we may see fewer such instances in the U.S. because there is more sensitivity, we may find more scandals in other parts of the world emerging because there's less oversight. Some of this, of course, reflects different laws in different in different countries or could reflect different laws or different approaches toward resolving any scandals or alleged wrongdoing. But I think we're still going to see that issue continue, unfortunately. And so whether you're a physician here or a physician somewhere else, it appears to be an open question to what extent is the pharmaceutical industry really changing the way it interacts with physicians and trying to do a better job, recognizing the need to do a better job of having appropriate interactions and promoting the medicines in a way that does not, not only violate the law or cost the government agency money, but potentially harm patients. Going back to J&J, one of the problems was with some of their activities concerning the Risperdal drug. As an example, the Janssen unit of J&J that marketed Risperdal pleaded guilty to misbranding by promoting the drug to treat psychotic symptoms and associated behaviors that were displayed by elderly patients. This is from the story I wrote. While these patients suffered from dementia, they were not schizophrenic, even though the drug was approved by the FDA only to treat schizophrenia. So, these problems resonate on many different levels. And now, with the Risperdal case, I should point out that some of this took place in a nursing home setting. The allegations involved Omnicare, which is the largest nursing home pharmacy in the country, and Omnicare also reached a separate agreement with the government for some of this stuff. I guess I'm getting close to the 9:30 mark, and I just want to say one other thing that it's the one thing that I guess that doesn't always come out, and I'm one of those journalists who's tried to make it easier for the average person, whether it's the average person who works elsewhere in the pharmaceutical industry or on Wall Street or Capitol Hill or an insurer or Madison Avenue. I mean, there are a lot of people who are concerned with what happens to the pharmaceutical industry for obvious reasons, as well as physicians and attorneys and academics, of course, too. And I try to talk to the whistleblowers as often as I can, so that I would run a question and answer interview when I could get someone to agree and sit still for long enough, and so that some of their experiences, what they've seen literally in the trenches, could be digested, and it doesn't become just another press release from the U.S. Department of Justice or some soundbite from an attorney who talks about how, terrible all this is. It's very difficult, I think, for the average person to understand how some of this works, because it's often behind the scenes. It's a complicated set of transactions, as we know, because, who's the customer? Is it the physician writing the prescription? Is it the person paying or partially paying for the prescription at the pharmacy? But the harm that's done is real, and it's unfortunate. And I don't know, as I say, if we're going to see a complete end to this sort of behavior, but it's up, really, unfortunately, it's up to the OIG to have some guts and really keep tabs on all this corporate integrity agreements that have been signed, and hold the drug makers' feet to the fire, so to speak, to use a terrible cliche, because if there really is an example made, maybe, and I mean, I mentioned Novartis in the case last summer, but just last week, it was Wednesday, January 8th, same U.S. attorney filed a lawsuit against Novartis in connection with a multi-million-dollar kickback scheme. So, maybe it's just Novartis. Maybe the government can't prove its case. But the question remains open, unfortunately. The issue has not gone away. So I guess on that note, I'll stop yakking and make room for the next.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Ed. I guess some of the discussion tonight will be what's really going to be a deterrent here. What's it going to take to really change these practices? Okay, so for the next 30 minutes, we're going to open the floor to questions and comments for Ed. But also, we're going to invite Wells Wilkinson and Steve Smith from Clean Catalyst to respond to some of these questions, because we really hope that we will make it possible for all of you to leave this call tonight with some really concrete ideas and a better understanding of resources out there that might help you deal with these issues when they arise for you wherever you happen to work. So what we'd like to do, I'm sorry, did I announce earlier that people should email questions to Becky Martin? I have a feeling I didn't, so let me repeat that, state that email address. Because we have so many people on the call, what we'd like to do is have people email questions to becky.martin@npalliance.net. That's Becky, B-E-C-K-Y, Martin@npalliance.net. And Becky will try and pull the questions together and give, and consolidate some of them perhaps. And we'll hope to get to all of them. And those that we don't, we'll make sure that they are conveyed to our speaker and you get a follow-up after the call. I think Becky has a few questions there to start out with while the rest of you are thinking about what you'd like to ask. And toward the end of the call, we can open it up for people to ask questions directly as well. But I think we have a lot of people on the line tonight, and that could be a little difficult. Becky, what do you have for us?
Yes, one of the questions that came in here, and as a few more are coming in, what, Ed, if you were looking ahead 3 years from now, what would be positive changes that you would, if you were king, what are the two things you would start with doing in the next 3 years?
If I were king, that's a long list. If I were king of the pharmaceutical industry, I guess the first thing I would look to see is the extent to which we've continued to see settlements. I mean, and if we continue to see settlements, are they reflective of years-old practices or ongoing practices, such as the Novartis lawsuit suggests? If I were king, I would like to see the administration, the Justice Department, continue to pursue allegations when they believe there's a serious issue. I'd like to see the OIG lean on some of these companies, and not that I don't have this skin in the game, but I think that they ought to be more willing to make an example of not just the company but an executive, and truly scrutinize the corporate integrity agreements. I think that the process should also be open to some form of transparency, because right now, every time I wonder whether a CIA has been, a corporate integrity agreement, whether one of the CIAs has been violated, there's no way of knowing unless one contacts the HHS OIG to ask, well, what's going on? And to a certain extent, they're not going, it's reasonable to understand they're not going to say everything about what they do, but we have no clue at all what kind of oversight exists. And I think that that's not to say the OIG has done a bad job, but we don't really know on an ongoing basis the extent to which they'll do a good job. So if I were king, I would like to see that kind of oversight in place, and I'd like to see them be willing to make an example of a company or even an executive, so at a large company, so it's clear that this sort of behavior can no longer be tolerated. And I'd like to see them also examine instances that do take place in other countries in the event that there might be a violation of U.S. law. There is something, by the way, I didn't mention before, called the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, and that involves paying bribes overseas. J&J and Pfizer have been tagged for violating the FCPA, but that has not yet been a factor in the corporate integrity agreements, at least not with Pfizer. So there is a way for U.S. federal authorities to determine whether there is a problem or not and really take action. And I'd like to see them connect those dots. And that's probably very high on my list if I were the king.
Okay. Let's have another question for Ed then, and maybe if Wells or Steve want to jump in, we'll invite them to do so. What do you have there for us, Becky?
Okay. So we have another question from someone in the listening audience asking, saying that they'd like to hear more about, is this institutional practices of big pharma or individual bad eggs that cause these huge, terrifying problems? And can we actually identify individual decision makers? And this, you know, kind of gets at what you were just talking about, and specific ways that we can help, as the physicians, the medical students online here tonight, could actually help to hold these people responsible for their criminal actions.
Well, criminal or otherwise, I think we're dealing with human nature, because it's a little bit of both. You have individuals who sort of go off the reservation, and maybe you have what I consider institutional pressures. I mean, let's face it, if you're working in one of these large companies, or even the smaller mid-sized ones, there's numbers to make. And, you know, the pressures are rough, and you know the penalty if you don't make the numbers, you could lose your job. So I'm being simplistic here, but that's pretty much what we can all understand and relate to in some way, I suppose. So that's what's driving a lot of the practices that we've been discussing and reading and hearing about all these years. So I think the key issue really is to identify, it's sort of like the Chris Christie issue going on in New Jersey, where the governor spent 2 hours apologizing and saying he's lied to, and then but doesn't really address the fact that there was a culture or environment that may have been created and allowed certain practices to occur. So I think to an extent it's a similar situation that we've seen in these large drug makers, where there's a tone that is, you know, it's related to business. Make the numbers, whatever numbers you're talking about, whether it's a set of prescription sales or a set of profits or what have you, make the numbers. And the question is, what kind of culture do we create for the people who must, you know, achieve those goals? And from the top down, are certain practices tolerated or encouraged? Do certain things get ignored in the name of achieving, getting those numbers? I think that all that goes on, really. And so the key question is, to the U.S. authorities, can they identify someone further up the top? And that's been very hard to do. And that's why we haven't seen exclusions of key executives from the largest companies. And so you would get a fall guy. You get a regional district manager who oversees reps who call on physicians. You know, maybe they lose their job. So that's happened to a couple of people at Pfizer over the years. You know, they come and go, and hopefully they get on with their lives once the issue is resolved. But that's not much of a game changer, unfortunately. So what can physicians do? I think, this isn't new. I think everyone recognizes this. You have to, you know, be very alert to when something may, whether it's a piece of paper, literature distributed, or something sent by way of email, or something said in person that suggests that maybe there's an inappropriate use that's being suggested for the medicine, and recognizing that it's not, you know, perhaps an accident or a slip of the tongue, or, you know, someone just pushing just a little too hard. It could very well be deliberate. I think for years, you know, the pharmaceutical industry was doing that sort of thing without, you know, too many restraints. Anyway, I'm talking a lot. We don't have a lot of time, so
Well, what can physicians do? That sounds like an opening for either Wells or Dr. Wells Wilkinson, Dr. Stephen Smith. Either one of you want to jump in here?
Sure, Rachel. I'll take the bait. This is Steve Smith. First of all, I want to thank you, Ed, for the presentation. It was extremely informative and inspiring. I can't think we can ever overestimate the value of what the Fourth Estate does for our society and keeping it informed and open. but it's also kind of discouraging, you know, what you hear, as you said, Ed, you know, the executives say, oh, well, you know, we've learned, those are old practices, we've changed the way we do things. It just reminds me of the old adage about leopards don't change their spots. And when we look at the set of incentives, the way industry is structured, you know, as you said, the pressures that exist now, and the equation, the calculus that the executives and people in the field do, you know, it doesn't add up for a change in behavior, unfortunately, I think. On the other side, you know, we mentioned, well, what can we do as professionals, and I'm sure there's lots of physicians on the call tonight, as part of the Partnership for Advancing Conflict-Free Medical Education, we've developed some toolkits talking about various policies that medical centers and medical schools can adopt to kind of change the culture in the profession of medicine, taking our own responsibility for our own behavior. You know, right now, you look at some of these antipsychotic drugs like Abilify or Seroquel, and I think the top-selling drug in the United States now is Abilify, and there just aren't enough schizophrenics to make that work out. So obviously, it's being used in ways that are not approved by the FDA, but are being sold by off-label marketing, and we have to be alert to that, just as you said. So if anybody's interested in looking at those toolkits we've gotten, go to our Community Catalyst site. But I want to take you back to changing that calculus and ask you some questions. You know, it dawns on me that in the antitrust area, when companies are found to have violated antitrust provisions, which is the bedrock of capitalism, there are treble damages. So whatever damages were incurred by that you know, illegal behavior, they have to pay three times that amount. You know, has there been ever any thought of legislating the similar kind of treble damages to the pharmaceutical industry for that? Or are there on the books, you know, criminal penalties that would have teeth that would hold the executives individually accountable for their actions? Anything along those lines, Ed?
I'd be honest with you, I'm not aware of that. I know that when the feds sit down and try to calculate the settlement dollars that we see announced, they do that on the basis of the number of false claims that were submitted. That would be the payments for prescriptions that were paid by a government agency, Medicare, Medicaid, for instance, and use a formula based on that, but it doesn't reflect, as you can tell, the same sort of suggestion that you're raising, which is very different. So, no, there's nothing like treble damages that I've ever heard of for this sort of issue. I might be wrong, but I don't recall hearing it.
So,
Welcome, Tim. I can weigh in a little bit on some of these issues. So, you know, one problem with the settlements that are occurring over the last several years are that they're being brought by the federal government on behalf of Medicare and Medicaid. And, you know, those two government payers are the biggest payers in the U.S., but they still constitute about 40% of spending on prescription drugs. And so there's 60% of the market that's commercial payers, like private insurance, et cetera. And those claims are not based upon the False Claims Act. They're based on other theories which are, you know, routinely getting defeated in the courts. So the pharma lawyers are, you know, kind of outgunning all the good class action lawyers that I've worked with in the past. And these cases just aren't being able to be brought. So that's one problem with the settlements being smaller than the kind of real market-wide damage that is happening. One other problem is the federal government bringing even kind of stronger penalties, because there's a law that allows the federal government to exclude a company from any participation in Medicare or Medicaid or any other federal health program if they commit health care fraud. and they're prosecuted of healthcare fraud. The problem is that it's a little, we call it the nuclear option. It's a little bit too powerful because if you convict Johnson & Johnson of that, then no drug that Johnson & Johnson makes will be available to anyone on Medicaid or Medicare. And unfortunately, there are probably some drug products that some patients probably need. And so that's why the Department of Justice, I think, hasn't been as aggressive in enforcing criminal penalties against the corporations themselves. And I think there are connections to how they might prosecute some of the individual CEOs as well. So those are kind of two limitations that they could kind of operate under.
Right.
But I just want to kind of make one point that, when I first saw a description of this settlement, what you said earlier about how these practices are kind of routine and you can just fill in the blank, that struck me with this settlement as well, because I had looked at another settlement from 2012 around the drug Depakote, where the same kind of practices occurred, where they were marketing this antipsychotic for use by seniors with dementia in nursing homes, and they were targeting what I consider to be probably one of the most vulnerable groups of patients who can't defend themselves and oftentimes don't have the social support to kind of defend themselves from the inappropriate uses of drugs. But I did kind of want to make the point that, there is some similarity in that settlement 2 years ago and this settlement. But one thing that did come out in that settlement, and I'm not sure if it's true of Johnson & Johnson, was that, there was really, really strong evidence that this was not like bad actors. It was actually a systematic program by the company over the course of 8 years to use a specialized sales force that targeted nursing homes and the pharmacies and the physicians that treat patients with dementia. And so there's no question that there may be individual pressure upon individual salespeople, but in that case, and in my opinion, all the other cases of the off-label promotion, there are corporate policies behind what's going on, because off-label promotion opens up your market significantly, and that's what these drug companies make, billions and billions of dollars.
And I agree. I didn't mean to suggest that it's only happening in sporadic ways among groups of people or individuals in large companies. It's tolerated, it's not encouraged, and as you noted in that particular case, it's mapped out by higher ups, for lack of a better description. And that's one reason that the feds are trying to depose J&J's Gorski, the CEO, because he was running or responsible for units where some of these shenanigans were taking place, and they wanted to see how much the high level executives knew, if not condoned at that time. So, by the way, one other thing to add, to another point you made, who's speaking out for some of the other groups? Well, there was an interesting court ruling last year. A federal appeals court panel issued some rulings against Pfizer specifically that could encourage insurers and health plans to file their own lawsuits if they can prove that they paid unnecessarily for illegally marketed medicines. And that's being watched. The Supreme Court more recently declined to Pfizer's request to put an end to that lawsuit. So now what's happening is the Kaiser Foundation Health Plan is moving forward with one, and Aetna is, I believe, going to move forward with another. So I think that is another avenue where we might see litigation. It's private litigation, but it is another form of a pound of flesh that could harm pharmaceutical companies for these sorts of practices.
All right. Well, thank you. So, Becky, let me just repeat the email very quickly. Becky.Martin@npalliance.net to send your questions in. Becky, you got a couple more there for us?
Yes, we do. Let's see. Here's one from Chicago. So Glaxo's SmithKline has launched its own transparency project, promising to make its clinical trial data available for review. It comes with limits, including independent panel to evaluate requests for data and withholding certain documents it claims violate patient confidentiality. Is this real change or window dressing? And how can we test it?
Sure, go ahead.
Well, that's sort of an open question. I think there are a couple of issues there that still need to be examined. And a key issue, and it's not just Glaxo, but it's other companies that have now agreed to participate in the same website Glaxo has created to allow for researchers to request trial data. And that is they're setting up their own gatekeepers to determine whether requests have merit and how they should proceed. And the contention is these panels or gatekeepers are independent. Well, as soon as Glaxo announced their panel, I found that one of the three members had at one time, not long ago, received some money as a consultant to the company. Now, that doesn't mean that that one individual is not intelligent or incapable of being a good gatekeeper, but if they're really going to be independent, find someone who has not served or worked as a consultant. And we don't really have a mechanism in place to determine whether a decision by a gatekeeper, whether it's at Glaxo or Roche or Sanofi, all of which have agreed to take similar steps as Glaxo now, will, we have no idea. There's nothing in place to determine whether any one company's panel is truly behaving independently. So I think that's really an open question going forward. There have been different ideas kicked around about how to make this work. I was at this interesting day-long seminar on this topic at Harvard last month where, I was listening to all these people try to kick around the ideas, and one is to have a sort of learned intermediary, which would be people appointed who are not working for, not appointed by any one drug maker, to serve as a gatekeeper on a wider scale. So you have something that is more uniform across the industry, not necessarily something that is company by company. That also poses challenges, of course, who's going to be serving on that kind of a panel and how are they overseen. But that might be more out in the open, at least. It's a step perhaps in the right or in a better direction. And already Glaxo, by the way, is being challenged by some researchers concerning specific data for the Paxil antidepressant, and they're bickering and haggling over case study reports that Glaxo feels they have the right to redact. And I've looked into this, and it's still unresolved. And I think that the overall effort to answer the question, and forgive me for being long-winded if I am, the overall effort, I think, is a step in the right direction. If something like this does have to start, I don't think it's going to be smooth or perfect or easy right away. But I do think the pharmaceutical companies have to do a better job from day one of being more open about it, because otherwise they're going to continue to run into problems. As one more small example of the sort, earlier this month, Sanofi, agreed to participate in the Glaxo site. But right away, the first thing I noticed was they're going to make trial data available, and along with related documents such as clinical study reports, but only for medicines that have been approved by the FDA and EMA on or after January 1st of this year. So if you're a researcher looking for data on a drug that was approved a year ago or 3 years ago, tough luck. Sanofi won't give it to you. So is that truly access? Not to me. I think that's a half a measure at best.
Yeah. Okay. We might have time for a couple more questions here. You got some more for us, Becky?
Yes, but let's see. Did Dr. Smith or Wells have anything to add to the last question?
No, I think we ought to try to get as many questions in as we can, unless Wells has something to say.
I actually do have kind of a question or a comment. I'm wondering, Ed, or any other NPA members or AMSA students out there, if any of you have seen anything in response to the J&J settlement about Risperdal in terms of, you know, provider or physician education about the misinformation that J&J put out in promoting Risperdal for the treatments that it did. Has there been any kind of corrective information or education of physicians that you've seen, Ed, or that other people on the call may have seen? And if not, you know, where could that kind of information be kind of shared or developed? You know, if it's not going to come from J&J, how could we play a role in trying to share that information?
I'll be very, very fast. No, I don't recall that. My suggestion might be, if this isn't simplistic, pressure, find a way to exert pressure on Congress and the Justice Department to make that a stipulation in these agreements, that the company should issue programs with corrective and correct information. That's widely disseminated on a regular basis to physicians or nursing homes or whomever.
Very interesting suggestion. The next question we have from the Twitter audience out there is, what effect will the Physician Sunshine Payment Sunshine database have on these practices, do you think?
Well, I don't have to be the only one to answer this. I think it has the potential for curtailing some practices, because my sense so far in talking sort of randomly and getting anecdotal feedback has been that generally people don't like showing up on lists if it's going to make others, you know, wonder about what they're doing. So I think that it'll probably change behaviors, and I think that when I talk to people at companies and some of the consultants I talk to regularly who specialize in regulatory and compliance business, they anticipate that it will probably force the drug makers to be a little more circumspect about how they spend money. And at the end of the day, I do think the word sunshine should be helpful. I think, as I said, it does hold the potential. I don't know where we're going to see, you know, how far the needle moves in 2 or 3 years as it's really kicked in. But I'm hopeful it will make a difference. Sorry, I don't have a better answer than that. It's hard to really forecast behavior.
We're going to have to wind up here in a couple minutes, but I wanted to give either Steve or Wells a chance if they wanted to for a concluding comment and to respond to this question, if you wish.
Well, just a quick one, well, Steve. Okay, go ahead, Wells.
So the, you know, I would say that the Physician Payment Sunshine Act has the potential to really have a chilling effect upon physicians' willingness to accept gifts from industry, and we're hoping that it will do that. So it may have an impact upon some of the things that we've seen in some of these settlements that are characterized as kickbacks, whether they're in whatever form they occur in. It won't necessarily have an impact on, you know, off-label promotion, because drug companies will still be able to lie to doctors about whether a drug is effective or not for users. So I think that will still kind of continue to be a problem. But, you know, what we're hoping to see is that in the context of just kickbacks, and Steve, you can comment on this as well, you know, the problem with the kickback scenario that we see again and again in these settlements is not just that the drug companies are making these gifts to physicians, but that physicians and the medical culture, you know, then accept them. And I think NPA and AMSA are doing excellent work teaching the medical profession that, you know, this kind of behavior is no longer acceptable. So I think that's, you know, that, those are important things that have to continue with, along with the Sunshine Act.
So, Steve, do you want to add something very briefly?
Very quickly, I agree that part of the settlements on these cases should go to re-educating physicians, but the way not to do it is the way the drug companies have done it, which is send out written materials in dense language that's really boring that no one will read. But I am thinking back, 40-some-odd years, actually 50 years, 1964, the anti-smoking commercials came out. The TVs were still having tobacco advertising on TVs, and the government required that there be equal time for anti-smoking commercials. They were so effective that the tobacco company itself decided to stop advertising on TV. So I think we need something like that, some of the monies that come from these settlements ought to go to some real smart Madison Avenue people about campaigns that will educate the doctors, the prescribers, and patients about the dangers and the inappropriateness of these behaviors. And I think if we really put that would be the kind of sunshine that would get the pharmaceutical company's attention and change their behavior.
All right, great. Great note to end our call on here today. Ed Silverman, we want to thank you very much. You're doing great work. We appreciate everything you've shared with us tonight. We expect we'll be hearing more from you over the coming months and years. Our next conflict-free call will be in approximately 2 months, so please watch your email for the date and information. Again, recordings and notes of this call and all our past calls are archived online at npalliance.org/conflict-free. For more information about NPA and this project, please visit the NPA Unbranded Doctor website. And for more information on the AMSA Pharmacy Scorecard, please visit www.amsascorecard.org. Thank you, everybody. Have a good night.